Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? Well, it's great to be here. I love being at these AA events. It's just a celebration. And I think every day in AA ought to be a celebration. And I can see that the AA up here is filled with that excitement and joy of living and all that. And, you know, there are areas around the country where there's, you know, like, well, I'm sober and this and that. And so I prefer to live where the people are all excited about the idea of being sober because it sure transformed my life. I really love it. My sobriety date is December 7th, 1964. And thank you. And that's Pearl Harbor Day. Coming up soon. And my sponsor's anniversary is August 6th of 1963. And that was Hiroshima Day. So we decided that it had something to do with getting bombed was how we ended up in, how we ended up in AA. And one of the great strokes of fortune for me is that I've had the same sponsor for 39 years. And that is a blessing because there is just a continuity of history between the two of us, even though 8 years ago I moved down to Florida and he's still up near the Washington, D.C. area. But it just goes back. That was the guy that came to my house, you know, when I made that phone call and he just came in. Hi, Tom. I just saw my buddy Tom sitting there. And he came in, and little did I know that I was about to undergo the biggest transformation in my life was this guy knocking on my door and taking over my life, which needed taking over. And I guess about 15 years ago, I forget, when we were celebrating one of his anniversaries, and he had moved down south of Washington. And so I called him up, and I said, Bill, I want to come down and get you, and I'm taking you and your wife out to dinner, any restaurant, nothing's too good for you. And he said, oh, I got one all picked out. You're really going to love this. So I went down and picked him up, and we got in the car, and we started driving up Route 1, which goes right up by the old Marine base that we, where we met. We were both in the Marine Corps. And he said, yeah, it's right up here, just up the road. And all of a sudden, we pull into this German restaurant that was the house I lived in when he 12-stepped me. It had been turned into a restaurant. And so we come up and come into the living room, which was one of the main dining rooms. And we're having dinner. And right towards where we're having the coffee after the dinner, he said, I'd like to point something out to you. I said, what's that? And he pointed over to the front door. He said, it's a long way from that door to this table. And he was just talking about what had happened in the 30 years or whatever it was since he came through that door. And so if there's new people here tonight, I'm sure somebody came through your door. And we think we come here to stop drinking. That's what it looks like. That's what I thought I was doing when I got here. But it turned out that there was a great deal more involved. And what it was I was going to be subjected to a process that was going to open my eyes to a world that I never dreamed existed. And it's real easy to stay sober in that world. Because in that world, in that spiritual world that we find in AA, there's nothing for alcohol to fix. And when there's nothing for alcohol to fix, it's real easy to not have a drink because you don't need it for anything. And I never dreamed this world existed. I'm just going to talk a little bit about my childhood and my vision of the world before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut in the 30s. My parents had been through the Depression. My father was an engineer. He graduated from Yale, went out and got a job, and worked for 1 year And there were no more jobs. You know, there was no engineering projects. There was nothing being built. And he was lucky to come back and get a job with the university. And he stayed there for the rest of his career in the maintenance and construction ended up. And he ended up, like, taking it over and being in charge of it near the end. But he would develop new ideas having to do with engineering, and companies would come and see him, and they'd go, "Well, Lou, why don't you leave the university and come with us? We'll double your salary." And he would just go, "No, whenever you work out there, you only work a year, and then everything falls apart. I'm going to stay here." So he had that psychology, if you know what I mean, that, "No, I'm not going to go out there because it's too dangerous." So things that happen, they really stay with us a long time. And I had one sister, and you know, I look back and it was a family that was reasonably happy. Everybody's going to church, we're doing all the things. And my sister now has 26 years in AA. I didn't even know she drank until I was going up to talk in Connecticut one time and she wanted to go with me. And I thought it was to hear me talk. It turned out she wanted to join AA and told me all about her drinking. So we started comparing notes about when we were little and how differently we saw things. It was astounding how the two of us in the same family, in the same thing. I remember when we were sent into the Catholic Church, I was terrified. I walked in there and those nuns looked at me and I saw stuff that was so intimidating and frightening. My sister thought it was cool. "Hey, aren't they funny in their little outfits?" And I'm going, "You're in deep trouble for laughing. I mean, this is serious stuff." And here's the two of us sitting on the same pew in the same church, and we're seeing two different shows. So she still loves the church and is so thrilled with it, and it's always been part of her life. And I sat there, and at age, I don't know, nine, somewhere in there, I had my first spiritual experience. And I was sitting in the church, and I was looking at the crucifix. You can't miss it. It's 20 feet high. It's hanging from the ceiling, a great big wooden cross. And I'm looking at it, and it was, you know, I've been thinking about all these things they've been telling me. And I'm staring at this, and it was almost like God said, "Little boy, I want to talk to you. I'm going to let you in on something." And I'm, "Yeah. Do you see that?" And I said, "Yeah, I see it." Well, that's what God did to his only son that he loved. Guess what he's going to do to you? So when I heard people talk of a loving God, I had, no. This is trouble. I didn't want to ever die. I was terrified of dying because that's when it was going to happen. So you can see I had this. But I didn't tell anybody. I'm like the rest of you. We never told anybody any of this stuff. And as a result, we collected a tremendous collection of ideas that our big book talks about, the old ones, that have to go. A lot of getting spiritual isn't getting anything. It's getting rid of things. I don't know if you've noticed that, but we really don't get anything. You just get rid of stuff. And then you can become who you already were. So it's I remember Chuck was telling me one time, he said, "You already are all that you can ever become. You just have to get in touch with it." And I didn't understand it. Foggiest notion what he was talking about, but it sounded rather bizarre. And then the longer I've been in here, I'm understanding what he's talking about, is to get rid of all these old ideas. I remember hearing a reading about a sculptress that did this beautiful sculpture in marble of a woman with long flowing robes. And it was just, when you looked at it, you just felt, you know, the impact of this marvelous creation. They asked her how she did it. She said, "I get a block of granite. I just get rid of everything that isn't the statue. It's already there in the middle of that block." And that's what we are. It's already there. We just got to get rid of all this junk that's on the outside that are old ideas. And so I'm collecting these old ideas. I got some right there from the church. I got frightened to death. A lot of it I gave to myself, and I would never share with anybody. I didn't want anyone to know that I had any problems whatsoever, because it was clear as I got into my teenage years that being cool was essential. And a cool person knows all and just walks around, yeah, I know that. I know all this stuff. I know everything. And I did not know that the other cool guys didn't know anything either. You know what I mean? I just, oh, man, that guy knows everything, and I don't. I hope they never find out that I don't, haven't got a clue what life is all about. But I'm standing here like I do. And so I got other ideas from the kids I'm growing up with. I got ideas off of bathroom walls and the great philosophers that put stuff in there, and you're sitting and you read it and you go, wow, is that true? Whew. God. But I'm not going to ask anybody. Then they'd know I don't know. So I got a lot of little stuff going in there, and wow, I didn't know that was going to happen. Wow. So this is what is collected on the inside, and then I'm just going along trying to be somebody, not having a clue. You know, we don't go through a class called Life 101. Hi, you're on the planet Earth. Let me explain to you how to live here and what happens on the inside and this and that. And this. If you don't have spiritual principles to live by, you're going to get lost. You'll be out there without a compass, and you're just going to be totally deserted. You know, there was none of that. It was just, hey, man, just be cool. You know what you're doing. Go. And so I'm out there doing the best I can. I ended up going to a little prep school in New Haven and got high grades, and I was a good athlete. And this school just fed right into Yale. I mean, it was just almost all our whole class just went down. It was a very small class. And when I got there, everything changed, because all the big shots from all around the country came to that university. And see, to me, it was just the hometown place. My father worked there, and I worked in the summer on the buildings. I was doing construction work and was climbing around doing steeplejack work. I like dangerous things to do, so I was doing that kind of work. But when I started mingling with these guys, they all were rich, they all were smart, they all had convertibles, they knew. They just knew things. They said, Wall Street, you know, stuff like that. And I'd go, what the hell is that, Wall Street? But they were comfortable saying Wall Street, you know, and like they'd been there or something. And so I started just having this feeling of being uncomfortable, and my roommates are going, well, why don't you drink? Drink makes you feel wonderful. No, I don't want to do that. I'm going to try for athletics, and I don't want to be drinking. I don't know why I was not drinking, but I wasn't. And they said, well, it'll make you feel wonderful. And I said, yeah, but I don't think I want to do that. But after about 2 months, maybe, of being there, I was at, and I tell this story every time I talk, I was at a social event in a room where there was a typed list of 30 names, and all you had to do was go in there and meet the other guys. Just stick your hand out and go, hi, I'm so, and just get to chit-chat with all of them. Well, that is something I don't know how to do. That is like asking me to go into a bull ring with a bull, you know, and just go, just take the cape and a sword and go in there. You'll be all right. I mean, it was that intimidating to me to even conceptualize doing this, because I didn't belong there. I had the feeling any time during that freshman year that the dean of freshmen was going to call us all out in the courtyard, about 1,000 of us, and he was going to make an announcement that there was an imposter in our midst who doesn't belong here, and he's right over there. And then they were going to get me and take me out of there. So that was the dynamics inside of me as I saw the world I lived in. And so at this event, I went over to talk to these guys, and you know, they would look over as I approached them, and in their eyes, they said to me, don't join this group. We already have enough friends. We don't want to know a guy like you. Did you ever have anybody talk to you that way, just with their eyes? Just look over and go, I can see from here you're nothing. Don't bother. Come over and talk to us. I can see, you know, and each group addressed me that way. Don't come near our group. We don't want to know a person like you. So I said, well, I tried. I never actually stuck my hand out. I kind of walked around and said, well, I guess I'll have to leave, which is what I did with a lot of situations. But the bar was there. There's a bartender. I went up and I started talking with him, and then let me have whiskey and something. I don't know what I had. And I drank some of it, and it tasted awful. And I'm going, God, I can't believe people drink this stuff. And I'm just drinking, talking with him. And I got through two drinks, and I had a third. And I'm waiting to feel wonderful. I don't feel a thing. Nothing. I don't feel a thing. And I'm just going, see, that's what they told me. You feel wonderful. This stuff isn't work. It's just nothing. So I put the drink down, I turned around to go out, and I looked back at those 30 guys. They were gone, and they'd been replaced by 30 of the friendliest guys I have ever seen. It was like, where did these guys come from? It was like, you could see right in their eyes, they all were looking at me, and they were saying, we'd give anything to know you. That was like, it was just right in their eyes. And I was so happy. I had all these new friends I hadn't met yet. And just, wow. And so I felt different. I had a little like this, you know what I mean? It was like, you know, they're right. They will be lucky to know me. And it was just this whole thing. So I could go over and talk to them. I had funny little things to say, no matter where they were from. You know, I knew. And it was as if my creativity, which had been stifled all those years by fear, anxiety, insecurity, could finally come up. So this is the first time I could be 100% me. And it was wonderful. I had access to all of me. And so I was liberated. It was just a miracle that I had found a way to see the world as a wonderful place to live in. And I'd only been drinking 15 minutes. You know what I'm saying? So that is, that's getting up there in the equivalent of a spiritual experience, if you know what I mean. And so I had many more drinks that night because obviously if three are creating this, what can we do with 25 or whatever? So later on, you know the end of that story, the room is spinning, I'm throwing up, I'm dying, and the worst night of everything. And then the next morning, I'm lying on the bathroom floor where it's cool, that marble tile floor, you know, oh boy. Then I'm throwing up and I'm lying there and I'm just dying. I finally crawl back into the room where my bed was in the dormitory, and I'm sitting on the bed, I just never felt that sick. And the thought occurred to me. I remember it just came right into my head. I'm sitting there at maybe 11 o'clock in the morning, and the thought was, well, are you going to drink again tonight? And it took about 2 seconds, and I just went, of course I am. This is a small price to pay for what I had last night. So that experience that I had the night before was so huge that this death feeling was worth it in order to be able to drink. So that was the trade-off that I made. So I already crossed right into alcoholism, where if you had come up to me, you know, if the devil had shown up and said, okay, you're going to have these sick feelings all the time, and you still want to drink, I would have said, yes. Okay, would you give up your high grades? Yes. Will you give up all athletics? Yes. I mean, What else would you give? I'll give up my family. I'll give up my soul. I'll give up anything to have that feeling I had last night. Now, I didn't know any of this was going on. I thought I was just a kid who was starting to party in college, because the other kids look like that. But if you had talked to those kids, they would not have said, oh, I just discovered alcohol last night. It's the secret of life. You know what I mean? They would have said, oh, yeah, it's kind of fun. I'm going to probably drink every Friday or something like that. I had a new center for my life, and I've been drinking one day. This was the centerpiece. I suddenly realized that if I kept drinking money in my possession at all times, there was nothing to fear about the future. That's how I felt about alcohol, just drinking one day. This stuff is amazing. I should have been drinking in grammar school. Those were some of my thoughts. I didn't have to have those feelings that I had back then. I could feel this way about, and it was so wonderful. I could hardly wait till 5 o'clock when the day was over and I could go get some drinks and transition into the world that I love. So the daytime world was the price you had to pay in order to enter the wonderful world at 5 o'clock. So I'm an alcoholic. I mean, my grades were terrible. I almost didn't graduate. No more athletics. Sick a lot. Getting in fights, teeth knocked out, going to jail. All the little things that come along when you when you have a new higher power, you know. And very briefly, the Korean War was just ending, but the draft was still on, so everybody had to join the military, and some guys were drinking beer one afternoon. They said, "Hey, we're going to join the Marine Corps. You want to go with us?" "Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, good night." I don't know anything about military, so I go down, sign up. "Yes, sir, I want to be a Marine." And not too many months later, I was going, "What am I doing here? I mean, this was like..." I remember thinking that I'd be going to bed, you know, and the sergeants are screaming and yelling. They're going out, and I'm going, "Man, these guys are intense. They ought to lighten up. And what is this?" And little did I know what was in store for me. But anyway, I made it through the boot camp type phase, and then we were off to 6 months training to be a platoon leader. No matter what you do in the Marine Corps, you're a platoon leader first, and then you can be a pilot or whatever. But everybody's trained to command infantry. So I got through with that, and I enjoyed it, but it wasn't who I was, so I knew I wouldn't make a career out of this. So this was, they were giving out regular commissions like they were free. And I saw a movie about pilots, a training movie, and the pilots were at a bar, if I recall, and they were talking with their hands, and there were blondes walking around in the background, and it was... It's like, you know, I'm looking at this, and so I asked this major, I said, "What's that pilot training?" "Oh, you don't want that." He was a tough infantry guy. "You don't want that. You'd have to sign up for 3 more years. I said, "Oh, that's all right. I'm interested in that." I really wanted to get away from what I was doing, and so I signed up. I'd never been in a plane. I don't think I'd been to an airport. You know. I mean, air travel just wasn't a big deal. And so I sign up, and boy, I get orders to Pensacola to become a naval aviator, and I've got married. My wife and I got on a plane, old propeller plane, United Airlines, going through Atlanta. You know, it's the only way you can get anywhere. And I got airsick on the way to Atlanta. I got airsick on the way to Pensacola, and I got airsick in the old SNJ for about the first 5 flights. I finished the flight, cleaned the plane. Finished the flight, cleaned the plane. And the instructor's going, "I don't think you're going to make it." But all that motion sickness eventually went away. And then it was like I was born for this stuff. I suddenly was getting to be the top in my class. I was going through everything, you know, gunnery, bombing formation, carrier qualification, all the stuff. And I am so excited that I found this thing. I loved it. And went overseas. And the war ended. Went over to Japan. It's party, party, party. In a fighter squadron over there. And the funny thing is that this just happened to me last weekend. I had made a call about 10 years ago. I suddenly wanted to go back and find those guys that were there in 1956. And just because it was such an important part, I loved it, and it killed me that I didn't finish that career, that my drinking took it away. It was the most important thing that ever happened in my life up until AA was being in those Marine squadrons, and especially that one, the first one. And I remembered one guy, and he was from Mississippi, and his uncle was a famous senator, Stennis. He was the head of the Armed Forces Committee back then, and this was his nephew. And so I said, "Geez, I know Senator Cochran from Mississippi," because I was then a lobbyist. I said, "I wonder if he knows Hardy." And then he could tell me where he is, and then I could establish this contact. So I saw him one night, and I said, "By any chance, do you know Hardy Stennis?" I think he would go, "Oh, you mean Senator Stennis' nephew?" And instead, he went, "Hardy Stennis? Everybody knows Hardy Stennis. He took an airplane into the Ole Miss football game one time and scared everybody in the stadium. Boom! And then went up like that, and he almost got thrown out of the Marine Corps." I said, "Yeah, that's the guy I'm looking for. That's the guy I'm looking for." So I called him on the phone, and like I said, it was probably 12, 13 years ago. And he said, "Who is this?" And I said, "Sandy Beach. You remember me, Hardy?" He said, "We all got the word that you died from drinking." And I said, no, I didn't. I almost did, but I didn't. I'm here. Oh, my God, I can't believe it's you. And he called some other guy, and that guy called me. He couldn't believe it either. He wanted to hear my voice. So we talked, and we were going to get together. But anyway, I called him about a month ago, and he said, there's a big aviation, Marine Corps aviation thing at Cherry Point, North Carolina. There's going to be four guys from that squadron there. So I went up to Cherry Point about a month ago, found guys I hadn't seen in 46 years, and one of them was from Charleston, South Carolina, and that's where the convention was last week. So I went there and got together with him and his wife, and turned out his father had joined AA in Charleston in 1948. And we went, and the Lexington is there in Charleston, and you can go on a tour. It's an old carrier. So there we are. Two of us with our bad knees, we can barely climb all the way up to the flight deck. And we're walking around in this beautiful sunshine, and there's two planes that we used to fly are on that deck. And we got pictures and all that kind of stuff. So this was a very exciting time, and I had this marvelous time over there. And the one thing I wanted to mention was everybody was partying. It was just, I felt like I was in heaven. We drank as a unit. The colonel would call us over to happy hour. We had a big table for 20 guys, a model of the plane in the middle, and you drank in rounds. You didn't order a drink on your own. The colonel would go, bring another round, and 20 drinks would come. We'd go around the table, and everybody was drinking all these tons of drinks. So I just felt like I was in heaven, that this was the standard way to drink. And one time, I've been there about 6 months, and we were out making practice carrier landings, and I was out there with a maintenance officer, a major, and we were watching these landings, critiquing our buddies, and he turned to me and he said, you know, I'm going to get promoted to lieutenant colonel someday, and I'm going to get my own fighter squadron. That's my dream. And I went, yeah, boy, major, you'd be a great CEO. He said, I'm going to get nothing but the best pilots in that squadron. Oh, yeah, you're going to get great pilots. He said, I'd like to get you in that squadron. And that was like, oh, my God, you couldn't get a bigger compliment. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And this is way back in the very beginning, in the middle of people who drank every day, and somehow my drinking stood out way beyond what the rest of these guys who were getting drunk every day did. So there's something about an alcoholic's drinking that puts everything else in a different league. But anyway, I somehow got through that, and then I ended up flying in the Marine Corps for about 13 years. And I was a flight instructor, did all these various things, but the disease was slowly taking over, so that I ended up at Cherry Point, North Carolina, flying photo planes. And I was having withdrawal symptoms in the planes. I would start losing vision. My heart was just racing. I was just consumed with anxiety, which withdrawals will do that, as you withdraw from alcohol, because you weren't drinking for 12 hours. It was a ticket for disaster. I talked to my friend Hal. He was an Air Force pilot. He said, no, you're supposed to take booze up in the plane with you. You don't want to go through withdrawal while you're flying. And I went, God damn. Air Force guys, they always know the secrets to this stuff. And so it was getting worse and worse. There was probably a period of 6 months there where I had a lot of close calls. I remember flying one time. And I'm sure everybody has this. Whatever your job, if you're an alcoholic, you're encountering situations that you're not supposed to encounter. You know what I mean? Like a doctor could be performing surgery, comes out of a blackout, he doesn't know what operation he's doing. And they don't teach you how to do that in medical school, because... And I'm sure somebody out here can tell stories about, you know, your job. Well, mine was keep flying during withdrawals when you feel like you're going to pass out. And that was not in the handbook. There wasn't anything in there flying this plane during alcoholic withdrawals. You know what I mean? So you're on your own. And I came up with the idea of flying the plane with one hand, finishing the photo mission, and the other hand on the ejection seat. And my theory was, I had such a death grip on there that if I fell forward, boom, it would fire me out. And the chute opens automatically at 15,000 feet or 10,000, wherever it's programmed. The plane goes and crash, and I'm fine. And it was And it was like I was terrified, but at the same time, I had that smug feeling like they almost got me, but the old fox found his way out. You know what I mean? There was, they almost had me, but I... And so that was the... Well, eventually that got so bad, I went to the doctor, and that just, boom, we can't have you flying when those things... There was no alcoholism as a disease. You couldn't be diagnosed as an alcoholic. There were no alcohol programs, and there was no such thing as alcoholism in the Navy. And so I'm down being examined by all these doctors, and they're going, well, now describe this, and I described it. They rigged an airplane, an old propeller plane, an old AD, and they put a chair in like one of these and bolted it, and then I'm in the chair, and I got wires all over me, and they're, oh, is this what it feels like? And, you know, we can laugh now. Oh, I see. You got an alcoholic and you're putting him in a chair and you're going around like that. And like the plane is causing the withdrawals. But if this is seriously going on, it took about 3 weeks of testing. I remember one time they were checking my teeth and the dentist said, God, you reek of alcohol. And I said, well, I got drunk last night. And he went, oh, well, then that's why you reek of alcohol. And he just went on. And so at the end of the time, they had to leave it up to the psychiatrist, and I was diagnosed as a childhood fear of flying. They wrote it all up. It just showed up all these years later. And after 3 months, I was given new orders to be an air traffic controller. And I went to air traffic control school. I made it through the school. And my last year, I was overseas in charge of an air traffic control unit in Japan. And fortunately, the senior enlisted men saw me when I checked in. They went, oh, my God. And then they just said, Captain, glad to have you here. Here's your coffee. Here's your tent. And here's this little thing. And don't go near the radar. We'll do all the controlling. So I just tried to get to work every day on my bicycle and back and forth. And it just was a terrible year. I lost about 50 pounds, malnutrition, just dying. And somehow got through the year, came back to Quantico. That's where I ended up, where I got my sponsor. Had a career school, and I had a grand mal seizure in the school and almost bit my tongue. And then off in the ambulance to the hospital. And 5 or 6 days, they're studying me to see what caused the convulsion. And no booze for 6 days. I went into the DTs, saw all these scary things. The CIA was doing stuff in my room, and they were trying to drive me crazy and lock me up forever. It was really bizarre. And evidently, I freaked out and was screaming down the hall, and they put me in a straitjacket and locked me up for 6 months. So that was how I got stopped in my path of self-destruction with a straitjacket. And somewhere in that stay, some AA guys talked their way into the hospital and said, you know, you got some alcoholics up there. Why don't we bring a meeting? So a corpsman came into the nut ward. All drunks fall in. And the three of us went down and attended that meeting. And I was very excited about it, but I didn't think it applied to me. I thought it was a great organization. The guys were so happy. And so I sort of paid lip service to it, and then I was let out as an outpatient, and within a couple of weeks, I was smuggling vodka back into the nut ward, even though they told me if I ever had another drink, my career was over. And one day, I just called, December 7th, I just called for help from my house, and my sponsor came over. The intergroup got a hold of him. He was the only other Marine going to AA down there, just two of us. And he just came, and I haven't had a drink since. He just came to my house and said, get in the car. I think that was the basic message of that day. Oh, hi, get in the car. We're going to a meeting. And he just took over, and, you know, and it's just been going on and on and on, and it's really been something. We get into situations sometimes when we're drinking that where you are confronted with two horrible choices. You know what I mean? It's just that seems to happen a lot. And President Kennedy's assassination, I was in Japan on my last tour over there when he was assassinated. And like a lot of people in the country, I just thought I was crazy about him and all that mystique, and it just really hit me deep. But I was also 6 months away from a convulsion, so I was right near the end of this of my cycle. And I was over in this squadron office, and they announced they were having the ceremony in the hangar at noon, and it was probably 11 o'clock. So I started calculating, well, one of those ceremonies takes about 2 hours. We're going to be standing at attention for 2 hours. I figure that's going to take 10 ounces of vodka for me to stand at attention for 2 hours. That was my calculation, because I had to go back and forth now every hour and get another slug, you know, to stop from just totally coming apart. So I'm on my bicycle going back to the Quonset huts to get the vodka. And I've already sort of planned it out. I'll take 4 ounces there, and I'll bring it along. And then right outside the hangar, I'll put in the last 4 ounces. You know, I had it all like a chemist measuring stuff for the mission. And I'm starting back to the Quonset hut, and a colonel came by in a Jeep, and he said, "Put your bike in here. I'll give you." "Oh, no, Colonel, I've got to drop over. I've got to get this." And he's going, "What?" I said, "Well, I'm going to come up with all these stories." He said, "Put your bike in." So I didn't get to get any medicine, and I was already starting to come apart. So now I'm standing there. I mean, just think about it. All I got to do is stand there. You know, when you're at that stage, you can't just stand there. There isn't any way you can do that. I remember when I first got to AA, I couldn't stay on the chair I was in. You know what I mean? It was like, hope this meeting ends soon, because I think I'm going to fly off this chair. And you know, it was... And I always wanted to sit in the back, and if I flew off, you wouldn't see me. So I'm standing there, and I could tell after about 40 minutes, I had sweat through the whole uniform. I looked down, and, you know, the sleeves, it was just like I'd just fallen in the ocean, and I was standing there. And I could hear guys back there, "Hey, you know, just little comments." Then my body started just, you know, quivering and just doing all these things. I think I was making little noises. And I'm going, "Okay, you're probably going to fall over. Should you run out or fall over?" You know what I mean? You got a lot of ego invested in this thing, you know, and all your buddies are standing there. "Should I run out?" "No, if you run out, they'll talk about it for years. Fall over? Oh my God, oh no." So I'm going, and all of a sudden I realize the band is playing and I'm going to make it. Somehow I have endured 2 hours of hell. And then I realize they're going to play the Star Spangled Banner and we're all going to salute. And my arm is doing this, and I know that if I put it up here, it's going to do this. And that's going to look funny. Or I could pretend I don't know you're supposed to salute like everybody else is. And so I'm weighing these things, and I chose not to salute. So now I'm standing there, you know. I mean, believe me, that is a terrible, terrible thing to have. And I can hear guys, you know, and all that. And as soon as it was over, I just got on my bike and raced back to get the vodka and get enough in me so I could pretend that that didn't just happen. You know what I mean? What ceremony in the hangar? I don't know anything about that. Let's go to town. But there was a lot of events like that, and I'm sure you've been through the same stuff I have. You had those kind of events, and they're devastating. They just stay with you a long time. And I've made everything up with my kids, with my ex-wife, with my parents, with everybody. And I just find it so hard to put the Marine Corps to rest. It's almost like somehow I should have been able to finish that career, and I ended up not getting promoted to major, and you have to leave then. So I had 14 years, and I'm gone. And you don't get to retire. You don't get anything. You just waste those 14 years. And I had 6 kids. Didn't know how I was going to feed them. I've been going to AA every day for 2 years. And I had a big resentment. You know, they want me to trust this new God. Not the one on the crucifix story, but this new one. This new AA God. And so I'm saying my talking to God after I got pushed out of the Marine Corps, and I'm going, well, I just want to thank you, God. I've been going to meeting every night. I've been doing everything I'm told. I've been praying to you morning, noon, and night, and you just crapped all over me and my family. I just want to thank you. It's a pleasure relying on you, God. I really... Now, I'm not telling anybody about this, because if you get a resentment and you tell people about it, they'll get it away from you. So I wanted to nurture this one, because this was a justified resentment. This one was beyond what you're supposed to accept. Do you ever have those? The ones that happen to you, those are the ones. And the funny thing is, about 3 months after I was out, I was reading the Washington Post, a little tiny story. Marine Corps instruction team from Quantico, Virginia, killed in plane crash in Denver. My unit that I would have been with if I got promoted was just killed. They're all gone, all the guys that I had been with, about 12, 13 of them. And I remember reading that going, God. And at first I felt terribly sorry for them. And then I knew that God knew. I just read that. And I'm going, I remember just going, well, if you just told me this was going to happen, I wouldn't have been screaming about how unfair you are. And so I guess I got my first lesson in just wait and see. Just acceptance, acceptance. Dr. Paul, boy, did he have the answer. Acceptance is the key to everything. I just really have come to understand that. Because until I accept it, there's no way I can get undisturbed so that I can open up a spiritual channel as to what needs to be done. So I really agree with that. I got a few minutes left, and I want to just talk to the new person about what I think the program has done for me. I always go back to Chuck's book, The New Pair of Glasses. It's a wonderful way of describing spirituality. It's like a person comes up and says, all troubled, and what's the matter? Oh, everything's all screwed up. I get this world, the people in it, everything is just awful. And you go, oh, you got the wrong prescription in your glasses. Give me those. And you give him a pair, and he looks back, and it's all straightened out. And that's what it feels like when we work these steps. Nothing really changes except our ability to see it differently. And when we see it differently, we see it as it really is. And it's marvelous. And it really is truly wonderful. And you told me that the core problem that I had was self-centeredness. Self-centeredness is the root of your problem. Self-centeredness. And a self-centered person may agree with that. I did. I finally saw what they were talking about. And I said, you know something? You're right. I'm terribly self-centered. And the next thing I said, and I've had a lot of guys I sponsor say the same thing, and I'm going to do something about that. Right? I'm self-centered, and I'm going to fix that. Well, how are you going to fix it? I'm going to become unself-centered. I see. What does that look like exactly? Well, I'm going to think more about other people. Well, how are you going to do that? Well, I'm just going to try. I'm going to, and the more you start thinking about it, there's no way you can become unself-centered. How could you become unself-centered? You can't. You're powerless over it. You're stuck as a self-centered person unless you can become God-centered. Now we have the antidote to self-centeredness. We become God-centered. And the second we become God-centered by working these steps and getting all the barriers, we call them character defects. I just call them blockages, barriers. These are the barriers to being God-centered. And we just have to get them out of the way. And then the channel is opened when those defects are removed. And this spiritual energy can start flowing so that we can be energized with a spiritual vision and we can see the world entirely different. And so that was what the process was designed to do, was to enable me to go from self-centered to God-centered. And when you get God-centered, everything's the way it's supposed to be. It was like back when they thought the Earth was the center of the solar system. And you remember that? You know, everybody studied that history. And then people were going, well, if the earth is the center, then this doesn't make sense. This shouldn't be moving over here. And as I calculate this, and it was like when they finally said, no, where the sun is the center, it was almost like heresy. My God, we'd have to change all our thinking in order for the sun to be the center. I can't give up all of my old ideas. And besides, all my maps will be wrong and everything. And I might have to go out of business. And so it was just very difficult to accept a revolutionary change like that. And the same struggle goes on when it's pointed out that we're self-centered. We got to become God-centered. And our character defects, in the 12 and 12, it has a wonderful sentence, instincts balk at investigation. Wait a minute. We don't want to be thrown out and all new ideas come in. We want to stay. We're good. We're valid. We're this. And so we spend the rest of our lives, you know, they talk on old timers. What do they say to each other? Well, 6 and 7, 6 and 7, 6 and 7. You're just going on and on for the rest of our lives trying to find out something else that we're wrong about so we can get rid of it. Because the freedom comes from getting rid of as many things that are wrong that I can get rid of. It's almost like I become a smaller and smaller vehicle. I become almost like a point of light. I've gotten rid of all these ideas of who I am and all of that stuff that I had learned from the early church and that I had misunderstood and the way I saw it as a little boy and the way I heard it from other guys. I had all these ideas about the world, and it was those ideas that were terrifying me. It was the way my mind worked that was scaring the hell out of me. And you came in and said, we're going to have to get rid of everything. So I remember in the beginning, my sponsor said, okay, here's what we do in AA. You got to stop drinking. I said, okay, I'm going to stop drinking. Maybe if you're new, you've heard, you've just gone through this process. And then after a few months, he goes, you know, Sandy, if you're really going to work this program, you're going to have to stop drinking and stop embezzling at work. You're going to get caught. I said, oh, so there's like two things you have to do. Yeah. So it's not just not drinking, right? Oh, okay, so AA is kind of two things. No drinking, no embezzling. And then more time goes by, and he says, you know, if you're going to keep that marriage together, you're going to have to stop those affairs. Oh, three things in AA. No drinking, no embezzling, no affairs. And then it goes on. I want to warn you, it gets up in the thousands. It gets up in the thousands of things. Every time you turn around, here's another one. Oh, I don't know. That has to go. And it's just remarkable. In the beginning, we hate it when they have to go. And later on, it's like, oh boy, goodbye. I didn't know that was wrong too. Goodbye. Here's another prejudice I got about this thing. You know what I'm trying to do this year? I'll never pull it off. And next year, starting right now, I want to go through a presidential political campaign without getting disturbed. I know I can't do it, but there's a real spiritual goal. Yes, I realize everything you're saying is stupid as hell, but God bless you. I think it's wonderful. I'm totally open to... Anyway, you can see where we're trying to go. The essence of the program is not being disturbed. It's right in the 10th step, that wonderful spiritual axiom. If something disturbs us, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. And what's wrong with us? We're disturbed. That's what's wrong with us. So this guy said that, and it disturbed me. So I have to do something to him. But what if I could get undisturbed? I wouldn't have to do anything. I didn't know. You know, when I was growing up with other guys, and a guy walked up and said, you're ugly, and so's your mother. And the other guy said, are you going to let him get away with that? I didn't know that I could turn to him and go, yes, I am. I am going to let him get away with that. I have to go now. See you all later. I didn't know you could do that. I thought you had to get furious and go get in a fight and do all these things. Those are old ideas that we're trapped with. And so I realize now with that wonderful axiom, I want to get undisturbed. How do I do that? Well, you write in the 12 and 12. Honest analysis of what's wrong. Self-restraint to start with. So that I don't do anything while I'm disturbed. My friend Ed talks about getting up in the morning, going out the front door, and letting five people be wrong ahead of time. It's just a little cushion. Just a little cushion. If you're new, you could pick next Thursday as anybody can drive any way they want day. Okay? And you go out the door that morning and just go, everybody drive any way you want. And watch how you can drive all over the place without getting disturbed because you're already saying, hey, go ahead. You'll cut me off. Go over here. It's a free day for you guys. Just do whatever you want. Now, who is it a free day for? Me. I go all the way to work without getting disturbed. It burns up a lot of energy to be disturbed. And when we're disturbed, we have a wonderful thing that we do. And alcoholics are very good at this anyway, bringing out the worst in others. It's our specialty. My parents were having their 50th anniversary many, many years ago. And my sister was planning it. She's in the program. She's giving me the list of the people that are coming. She got to this one uncle and I went, oh, God, no, do we have to invite him? And she said, why? And I said, God, he's so obnoxious, Sue. He ruins events, the family events. He's just abrasive. He says these cruel things. And she said, he only does that when you're around. And I went, what? How could that be possible? But she's in AA, got about 15 years. And I go, well, maybe she's right. You know, so I'm going to act like I think he's wonderful. And I remember going up, Uncle John, I'm so glad to see you. And he said, I'm so glad to see you. And it was just like I emitted love and it transformed everything. And so as we go around undisturbed, in other words, that's our goal, to be spiritually undisturbed. We do that. We got the self-restraint, honest analysis of what's going on. We might have to call somebody else. And if it's their fault, we forgive them. If it's our fault, we make an amend. Boom, we're undisturbed. And that's the place. So as we go around undisturbed, we bring out the best in people. We go into the dry cleaning. Our dry cleaning isn't ready. We really need it. And we go, that's okay. I'll be back tomorrow. Instead of ripping the throat out and leaving the lady lie on the ground. So as we leave there, she's, oh, God, I'm so happy to have people in the world like that. And then we're in the supermarket. We're over here. We're over there. And we just light up our world. Everybody that we touch is responding to the spiritual energy that we are bringing, and we indeed transform the world that we live in by simply going inside and changing the flow of the energy. The last thing I wanted to say was, if you're new, go to the 11th step and the 12 and 12 and get that prayer of St. Francis. I mean, I love the Serenity Prayer, but this one is miles ahead for me. I mean, I like the prayer of St. Francis. And you will find in there, this is what we are talking about, what we should pray for. And you look at this, look, this is the prayer I want more than anything in the world. And what does it say in there? Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. Make me a channel of thy peace. I remember the first time I read that, I said, wouldn't that be wonderful? I read these character defects, the channel opens and God's peace comes in and I feel wonderful. It's not what it says at all. I open up the channel and God's peace comes out. And it goes to others, and I feel wonderful. It's already in there. Open the channel. Make me a channel of peace. That where there's hatred, I can bring love. That where there's discord, I can bring harmony. That where there's darkness, I can bring light. And it just reverses all the energy. And it teaches us we don't need anything. There's nothing that we need. We've misdiagnosed the discomfort that we have inside of ourselves. What we need to do is give. That's all that's been wanting to burst out from inside of us all these years, is to not be so self-centered and just allow all of that raw spiritual love that's inside of every single person to be set free on the world that you live in. And you will be where Chuck talks about with that new pair of glasses. And all you'll be able to talk about is what a great world we live in. I'm looking out here tonight and I know I'm right. Thank you very much.